Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this now. Courtroom combat.
It's the final episode of December, the final episode of 2017 on Legal Faceoff. We're in the Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. Rich Lenkov, Tina Martini in the house. My name is Sam Panionovich, and Craig Collins is across the glass. We'll talk about Cook County Board Commissioners, the candidacy, the campaigns. We'll also talk about athletics transitioning into law. And, of course, at the end of the show, the legal grab bag with special guest Nikki Allen of the Apogee Lounge. And we'll get into all that stuff later on. But we open up this show. We will go out and find Michelle Gay, who's the founder of Safe and Sound Schools. The website is safeandsoundschools.com as we remember the legacy of Newtown. We welcome Michelle to WGN. Hello, Michelle.
Hey, how are you?
It has been 5 years since the horrific Sandy Hook tragedy, which claimed the lives of 20 children and 6 teachers, including, Michelle, your youngest daughter, Josephine. How have we as a society, including organizations such as yours, Safe and Sound Schools, addressed the awful lessons that we've learned through Sandy Hook, and how have we been able to make our schools safer?
Absolutely. You know, there have been a tremendous amount of great efforts that have come from our horrific tragedy. And I think we're all really uniquely inspired by the loved ones that we lost. And I think for us, it's about schools. It's about what was important to our daughters. So I'm the co-founder of Safe and Sound Schools. And my partner in founding this organization is Alyssa Parker. She also lost her daughter, Emily. And for our daughters, school was everything, you know, the school community, friends, teachers, learning, getting up every day and putting on a fresh new outfit. It was everything. So for us, that became our focus. And that was a place where we knew we could affect positive change and really bring communities together for the better of the school community.
Michelle, how do we keep the focus on these issues? Because it seems, unfortunately, like every time there's a tragedy, and unfortunately there's no shortage of them, we have a big public outcry, there's a lot of attention, but then it tails off very quickly. I mean, I'm thinking of Vegas, right, the tragedy there,
yeah.
And President Trump came out and said, oh, I can't comment on it now, it's not appropriate. The frustration for a lot of us, and I'm sure you're in that group more than anyone, is, well, okay, if it's not appropriate now, when is it appropriate? I haven't heard Trump or anyone from the administration come out since then and say, oh, yeah, it wasn't appropriate, it was too early, but now it's appropriate. It seems like this stuff is forgotten, you know, way too quickly, and we're not really doing anything to move the ball forward.
I hear you on that. I think, you know, in the immediate wake of a tragedy, those of us who are, you know, at home, far away, we want to jump up and take action right away. And I think it is wise to take a little time for the sake of the victims and their families to offer thoughts and prayers and let them recover a little bit, find their feet a little bit, and think about how they want to honor their loved ones, because I know that was the case for us. But you're right. You know, we don't want to continue on this Ferris wheel of starting in one place and going around with the impassioned speeches and the cries for change and, you know, let's new laws, new legislation, and then somehow we end up in the same place. And I think for us, that's why we came to this. We realized that real change, real power could take hold at the grassroots level in communities when everybody comes together, you know, teachers, parents, law enforcement, fire, everyday ordinary community members. We all want our school community to be as safe as possible, and we really can't put that on one person's shoulders in this day and age. It's something we all have to do together. And there's no magic pill, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all, unfortunately. Of course, it would be wonderful if that were the case, but it's going to take all hands on deck. That's the reality.
So, Michelle, we know that this is really a multifaceted, nuanced set of approaches that are needed to address such an important issue as school safety. What steps have been taken? I mean, we've all seen the news about how schools now are doing things like active shooter training and things like that. What is there? What have we decided to do, at least preliminarily, in the wake of all of these tragedies, in terms of trying to ensure the safety of our children? And I know that your organization has been very involved in much of that. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. I think what we're seeing, which is a positive, is we're seeing folks, like I said, coming together at the community level, taking a look at the resources that they have, the people that they can tap into, and really setting into place some strong education and training programs. And for some, that's going to be active shooter training, and that can mean a lot of different things, of course. You know, there is one way that we train our police officers, and there's another way that we train our second graders, for example. But it does come down to education, and I would liken it to fire safety and the great history of success that we have in this country with fire safety education and training. We've all, the three of us, have been around long enough to remember, I don't know how many fire drills, right, that you've participated in, and learning about stop, drop, and roll, and all of those other things. We don't think anything of it in this day and age. But there was a time when that was new and frightening and scary. But breaking it down into, you know, bearable bits for youngsters, for community members, providing them education and tools to feel empowered, that's how we got to where we are today in terms of fire safety. And we have not had a fire-related death in a K-12 school in nearly 60 years in the United States. It's hard work. It's not, again, it's not the magic pill, the one-size-fits-all. And it does take time and effort, but look at how successful we can be when we apply that formula.
Michelle, you're a former teacher yourself. Are schools nationally right now doing enough in terms of educating both parents, teachers, students about how to deal with these situations? Obviously, it's a sensitive subject. I think, to your point, we need to maybe demystify it and make it a little more accessible. I think the challenge, obviously, is you don't want to, you know, freak out little kids about this, but I think, you know, you have to. And I think part of your mission is to make it easier to speak to children about that. That's my first question. My second question, and we'll let you go after this, is should teachers be armed? I mean, I know a lot more teachers are armed now than they were before. Is that also part of the solution, you think?
That's a great question. And again, we're advocating for a really community-based approach. So, you know, we say to folks, go ahead, put all the options on the table and turn them all over and explore the pros and cons of all of them. Ideally, we don't want to have to see that teachers are armed. You know, I was a second grade teacher, and I can only imagine how difficult and distracting it would be to be sitting crisscross applesauce with my little second graders in our reading circle and, you know, a firearm on my hip. For so many reasons, that just doesn't feel right to me. But the reality is that there's a tremendous amount that we can do before we get to a place like that. There's a tremendous amount that we can do. Look at the Rancho Tehama school that just, you know, experienced an active shooter on their campus and quickly, like in seconds, was able to lock the school down just because the teachers had been so well trained. They were hearing sounds of potential danger, didn't even know what it was, but they took quick action. They locked the school down, and that intruder was never able to break into the school to do the harm that he intended. So, you know, there's a lot we can do in small steps to get to where we need to be. I certainly personally don't love the idea of teachers being armed. I recognize that in some communities, they have to look at that option because their response time, you know, after they call 911, it may be 50, 55 minutes. They may be a rural community. There are all sorts of different factors. So, again, there's not a one-size-fits-all. And we encourage folks to really explore all options and think about what are going to be the least, interrupting, the least odd or changing or traumatic kind of things that we can do that can be the most effective.
Michelle, thank you so much. We're going to let you go, but, from both of us, we want to really, of course, extend our sympathies on your loss, and thank you so much for all the work that you and your fellow advocates are doing on this really important subject.
Yes, thank you very much, Michelle, and happy holidays to you and your family.
You too. Thanks, both of you.
That's Michelle Gay. She's one of the founders of Safe and Sound, a Sandy Hook initiative. For more information, safeandsoundschools.org.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off, WGN, WGNradio.com. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, also on iTunes. Make sure you check it out, rate, review. You can share with a friend. Joining us on the phone, he's the president and co-managing shareholder of Nyhan Bambrick, Kinsey & Lowry, and he's also running for Cook County Commissioner in the 3rd District. He's Bill Lowry, and he joins us now on WGN. Hello, Mr. Lowry. How are you?
I'm doing great, and happy holidays to you and the WGN family.
Happy holidays, Bill. You're a very prominent attorney. You and I have known each other for many years. You're also very involved in the community. Tell us what prompted you to run for the Cook County Board.
Rich, I've known you for a long time. I've enjoyed our relationship, and as you know, I've enjoyed the practice of law. But long ago, I knew, I just felt in my heart, I had to do more than just practice law. So I volunteered, and I presently serve on 14 different boards just to try to give something back when I'm not in the courtroom. And what finally got me to today was actually January 29th, 2013, when Idea Pendleton was shot and killed 10 feet from my backyard. One of my three kids challenged me to do something more, and that was really the time that I started saying it's time for me to serve in a more impactful way.
So, Bill, what do you hope to accomplish by joining the Board of Commissioners?
Well, I think effective leadership is rooted in communication, which is listening as much as speaking, collaboration, which I don't think we see enough in elected officials, and in action. And these are skills that I will bring to this position should I be elected on March 20th.
Bill, tell us more about your feelings on the Pendleton case. We covered it here on Legal Face-Off extensively. I know it was in a neighborhood that you're very passionate about. Tell us what your thoughts are on that tragedy and also what your plans would be if elected in dealing with it.
Right. Literally, it touched my doorstep. As I said, it was 10 feet from my backyard where this occurred in a play lot where my three kids often played as they were growing up. And I really think that it underscores a violence that all of us are facing in the Chicago area, and that's violence. And I believe through economic development and jobs, and not just economic development and jobs, but also workforce development and a placement effort, and then also buy-in by our financial institutions, we can ensure that there are job opportunities, not just on Michigan Avenue, but throughout the entire 3rd District, not just large businesses, but even small businesses, not just majority businesses, but also minority-owned businesses, and jobs will reduce violence. The other thing, Rich, not only health care, but mental health care. A lot of our residents in the 3rd District, they really need mental health care given the conditions that they face on a daily basis in some of our communities. Mental health care will also reduce violence. So that's the piece. I think there are a lot of different ways to get at the violence epidemic, and I think we need to do it.
On the issue of the mental health care, what specifically do you think that we could be doing better?
Well, I'll give you an example. Before I was running for office, I was working with Bright Start Community Outreach and Pastor Chris Harris, and we are bringing to the Bronzeville area the Turn Center, where psychological counseling will be available for teens and families who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, often the result of being exposed to violence. This is based on an Israeli model, and ministers have been trained by a number of individuals from Israel just about how to go about providing this type of very important counseling. I think this type of effort could be a template not only for my district but for the city.
Bill, where do you stand on the sweetened beverage tax that's gotten a lot of attention in the public, in the media, on our show? We had Bob Fioretti last show on, who is running for Cook County Board President. What are your feelings on that, and what is your relationship like with Tony Preckwinkle?
Well, let me first say I have the utmost respect for the president. I actually served as her finance chair for over 7 years. And I said to her, once I found out Jerry Butler was not seeking re-election, and I then was seeking a seat, I said, I'm not in support of the sweetened beverage tax. And I said to the president, if that means you have to support another candidate, I understand that. And to her credit, she not only understood, but she respected my independence. And she said, Bill, I think you'll be a great commissioner, and I'm with you all the way.
Why were you against it?
I didn't think the messaging was right. And I think that it's very important that we are always in integrity when we're reaching out to those that we are representing in any way, let alone as a public official.
When we had Bob on our last show, we had asked him about his ideas of trying to bridge the gap with that $200 million shortfall in the budget. Do you have some thoughts as to how to make up for that?
Oh, I do. And again, you know, Tina, this is something that I was working on before I even knew I was running for office. When you look at this budget compared to previous budgets, there's not an allowance for a couple of pretty substantial federal-supported programs. Specifically, the Community Development Block Grant Program, previously funded, was funded at $113 million. Also, the Home Investment Partnership Program was funded at $4.2 million. I don't understand why we do not still try to get those dollars. We have friends in Washington, whether you're friendly with the Oval Office or not. We do have friends in Washington. Those are our dollars, and that's an example of over $117 million that I will certainly continue to try to bring to the county, whether I'm a commissioner or not.
That's Bill Lowry. He's running for commissioner on the Cook County Board in the 3rd District. Jerry Butler is not seeking re-election, so we wish all the best to you, Mr. Lowry, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at DLA Piper and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina is chair of DLA Piper's Intellectual Property Practice Group in Chicago, and she serves as the firm's national hiring partner for associate recruiting. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell, and selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is a columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host. She frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. DLA Piper is a global law firm with lawyers located in more than 40 countries throughout the Americas, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia Pacific. DLA Piper is positioned to help its clients with their legal needs around the world. To learn more about DLA Piper, please contact Tina or visit DLAPiper.com.
We welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here as we power through the final episode of December, and we go back out to the phones, and we're joined by Bridget Degnan, who is running for Cook County Commissioner in District 12. She's a longtime Chicagoan, grew up on the Northwest Side, and the Facebook page is Citizens for Bridget Degnan, BridgetDegnan.com, D-E-G-N-E-N. Hello, Bridget. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us, Bridget. So why don't you tell us what made you decide to run for the Cook County Board?
So I have worked as an environmental engineer and an attorney for about 25 years. And I also have experience in public service by being a returned Peace Corps volunteer. I served in West Africa for 2 years and 3 months. And as I look around Cook County and see what's going on the county board, and particularly my opponent, and see, you know, that he's missed a lot of subcommittee meetings, he's missed important votes, and I really don't feel like he's present or has a passion for this position anymore. So I really felt like somebody should run against him, and I have the knowledge and the passion and the experience to run against him and do a great job on the county board.
Who is your opponent?
His name is John Fritchie.
Okay. So we just had Bill Lowry on, who's running in another district for Cook County Board. We asked him about his position on the sweetened beverage tax, which obviously is one of the biggest issues that's gotten attention over the last 12 months in Cook County. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think you don't need a poll to tell you that that sweetened beverage tax was terribly unpopular. But the result of that was to raise almost $200 million. And I really believe that we shouldn't just look to Tony Preckwinkle as the president of the board to generate ideas on how to generate revenue. I think if you're on that board as an elected official, you have an obligation to come up with new ideas about how to generate revenue to support Cook County's hospital and affiliate system, the forest preserves, buildings, and infrastructure, and jobs. And I have some good ideas about how to generate revenue.
Tell us what those are. Yeah.
Rich and I were like rock, paper, scissors for who was going to ask that first. What are some of your ideas to bridge that gap?
So just like the federal government can expedite things for you, if you need a passport really quickly, they'll charge you $150 and get you that passport fast. I think Cook County can use their own expediting services. There's records, there's hospital records, there are court records, there are services in Cook County, all of which could be expedited for a fee. People will pay for that convenience, and there's already an infrastructure established to get you those records or services.
Bridget, how do you think your experience as an engineer and as an attorney would have prepared you for your potential role on the board?
As an engineer and as an attorney, you know that if you do the hard work, there's always a solution. In engineering, there's always an answer. You just need to find it. And I think I've always worked really, really hard to make sure that I'm responsible, that I get the answer that is the reasonable answer. And so, you know, being on the county board, there's a lot of problems. Those problems need solutions. They don't just need talking points and buzzwords and people getting their face in the newspaper. They need people that are going to drill down and do that hard work. And that's what I'm all about. And so I've committed to be a full-time commissioner, meaning I will not be a registered lobbyist. I will not have a law practice on the side. I will not do real estate deals on the side. I will be a full-time commissioner working on the board exclusively.
So, Bridget, it looks like the recreational marijuana issue is going to be on the ballot in March. And you obviously have been very involved as a regulator with respect to the Illinois Medical Cannabis Pilot Program. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, if you look at the person that proposed that ballot initiative, it's the person I'm running against. And again, I think that the person, my opponent, has a lot of experience in sound bites. So that's a non-binding resolution. Really, the state has an adult use bill that's pending. If that bill gets passed, it will not be under Governor Rounder. So we'll have to wait for the next governor to be in there, possibly whoever, if it's the Democrat, next Democratic governor, they'll be sworn in. Then they're going to fill their cabinet, and you know, then we're at veto session. I think the first time that bill is going to be passed, potentially, is 2020. It'll be implemented 2021, and the first dollar of tax revenue that's going to come from if that bill is passed, too big if, meaning if we have a new governor, and if that bill is passed almost as soon as it possibly could be, we're looking at 2022 for the first dollar that could be taxed on recreational cannabis. That's 4 years from now.
That's Bridget Degnan. She's running for Cook County Commissioner on the County Board in District 12. The website, BridgetDegnan.com, and on Facebook, Citizens for Bridget Degnan. You can spell it D-E-G-N-E-N. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our final guest on this episode of Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGNRadio.com. We cross the border to the north, and we find Jock Climie, who is a partner at Eamon Herndon, but also he had a 12-year career in the CFL. Rich, you're very excited because you love the CFL. You're a big Jock Climie fan. Jock, welcome to WGN.
No, thank you very much. Pleasure to be on.
As you know, friends, we've had a lot of celebrities on the show that have excited me. But, yeah, I'm super jacked up to speak to Jock. Jock, I've been watching you for a long time, following your career. I am Canadian, grew up in Montreal, emigrated here back in the day, but still an avid CFL fan. For those of our listeners who don't know the CFL, it's the Canadian Football League.
Why are you looking at me like I don't know?
The one that actually knows that you only need three downs. You need, you know, a longer field. But, yeah, Jock, you were, as Sam said, you played 12 years in the CFL for the Alouettes, Rough Riders, back when they were called the Rough Riders, and the Toronto Argonauts. And now you're on air. You do a lot of color for TSN, the sports network. So, first of all, tell us how you transitioned from being a professional athlete to being a lawyer.
Well, actually, it went the other way around, really, because I was playing at Queen's University here in Kingston, Ontario, and I had finished 3 years of university football and got into law school. So I did my fourth year of football as my first year of law school, and then all of a sudden I was drafted in the first round by the Toronto Argos and had to figure that out. Had to figure out how am I going to how am I going to do these two things? And I went and told the dean of the law school, and I said, hey, I just got drafted by the Argos. Any chance I could just do law school in the winter semester? And they'd never had anyone do that before, but thankfully they were prepared to be flexible, and that started off really what's been a 27-year a love affair with the law and football.
So how have you how do you think that your perspective as a lawyer who's also a professional athlete, what kind of lessons do you think you've taken from being a professional athlete into the law? Because, it's interesting when I talk to folks who have had a prior career, especially as an athlete, I think that there are some interesting parallels between being an athlete and being a lawyer. What have you encountered from your experiences?
There are lots of overlap. And in fact, I've done a lot of public speaking over the years, and I do a little segment where I talk about how professional football and business, whether it's a lawyer or any other type of business, how they intersect. But, at the top of my head, I would say the things that come to mind, first of all, is work ethic. So, you can't be a professional athlete without knowing how to work hard and prepare. And obviously you can't be a successful lawyer unless you do the same thing. And then competitiveness, as a lawyer, certainly as a litigator, being competitive, that desire to win, not win at all costs, not win by cheating or sharp practice, but just that competitive desire to do the best job you can, I think is also served me well. And then teamwork, knowing how to work with your associates, your partners, whoever it is, your clients, to achieve a good result. I brought a lot of lessons that I learned from the football field right into that, right into the law firm.
Jock, by the way, Jock's a three-time All-Star in the CFL, recipient of the Lou Hamon Trophy, which, of course, as Sam knows, is for the top Canadian in the East Division of the CFL. We've covered on this show a lot the CTE issues in the National Football League and in other leagues, and also lawsuits surrounding that. What's your position on that? And are you seeing any litigation in Canada for athletes seeking damages for their time playing football?
Yeah, there's been a little bit. The CFL has been sued by one particular individual, former receiver who played during my era, who had some concussions, and he's done his level best to try and reproduce some of the success of the lawsuits against the NFL. So far, he's had no success. I don't see that as being something that can be duplicated up here. What happened with the NFL? I mean, I think. I don't know a ton about it, but from what I do know, the NFL got itself into some trouble because it appears there were some findings that they had tried to mislead and cover up some scientific research or knowledge. And the CFL just hasn't had that. No one had their finger on that pulse. No one was tracking it. This is not enough money in the CFL for anybody to bother trying to cover anything up. So,
it should also be pointed out that litigation is different in Canada, right? I mean, at least as far as personal injury lawsuits go, it's just a different climate in Canada. I mean, Canada's much nicer than the U.S., and people just don't. I mean, certainly there's personal injury lawsuits all the time, but it's just not the same legal environment in Canada as it is in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I think the U.S. tends to be more litigious, but. There's no question that if people could see a way to make a quick buck by suing, they would. But I'm a mixed mind. I mean, I feel for anybody who's obviously suffered from any ill effects. But we all knew what we were doing. I mean, you don't play professional sports without knowing there's risk. Obviously, nobody knew that getting a concussion in your 20s might lead to serious mental health conditions or brain damage later in life. But I don't know. If we did know, would anybody have stopped playing if you knew you had a 10% chance or a 10% better chance or whatever it is? I don't know. So, but we all knew it's a risky business.
Jock, there's a lot of NFL players that say they wouldn't let their kids play. I'm not sure if you have kids or maybe you don't, but if you did, would you let them play football?
Yeah, I've got a 10-year-old son who played his first year of football this year. So, he's been playing hockey since he was five. He wanted to play football this year. I let him. He had a concussion playing hockey a couple of years ago. I don't know. I'm waiting for the research, right? I mean, I think there's so many of us who just it's very easy to just run scared and want to bubble wrap your kids out of a fear that something's untoward's going to happen to them. But we all grew up in an era where no one particularly concerned about that. And yes, there are people who obviously are suffering some side effects and some ill effects from that. But, you know, I think generally speaking, we all survived. And, you know, until somebody, tell a scientist, a scientific research paper comes out that conclusively proves that there's exponentially more risk by playing contact sports as a kid, I'm not going to tell my kids they can't.
We're definitely also very happy to see Mark Trestman have some success back in the CFL. Great Cup champs, baby.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. He's just as a guy with I don't think practice law, but he certainly has a law degree, and he approaches the game of football the way a lawyer approaches a file. Very, very analytical, very cerebral, fabulous leader. Took a team that was dead last in the CFL last year and brought them all the way to a Grey Cup championship. Mark didn't have a lot of success in the NFL as his last go-around, but, wow, he's a class act, and we're happy to have him back up here.
Really quick, Jock, will we see expansion into the Maritimes? I know there's a proposal to expand finally into the Atlantic provinces. Will we see that in the coming years?
Yeah, finally. You know what? It's looking more promising than it has in a long time. Folks might remember there was 1.5 U.S.-based teams in the CFL.
Right. I remember.
And, you know,
Birmingham. Birmingham,
Freeport, Las Vegas, Baltimore. There's a whole bunch of them.
The hotbed of football that is Shreveport, Louisiana.
Yeah, that's right. Guys going down there and playing 105 degree weather in July. It was crazy, but you know that experiment didn't work, obviously. But I really feel that if we can get a 10th team in the CFL, that would even out the schedule. Make sure this game goes coast to coast, Vancouver to Halifax. Really, really excited, but it's we're a ways away. They got to have to build a stadium that's going to be probably $100 million plus $200 million, and that kind of money is kind of hard to find. But up here, but hopefully they'll get it done.
The booming voice of Jock Climie, who is a partner at Eamon Herndon and also had a 12-year career in the CFL. Thank you for your time.
Hey, my pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Time on Legal Face-Off. Rich Lenkoff, Tina Martini, Sam Panionovich, David Sussler is here, but he has been muzzled. He does not want to speak. Craig Collins, and also joining us for our party episode is Nikki
Woo!
Allen.
Hi, guys.
Who's at the Apogee Lounge, and she's on Twitter.
I need sound effects. Keep going. I'll bring some sound effects in.
At Nikki Epicurious. N-I-K-K-I.
There you go.
Epicurious.
Perfect.
There you go. It's just one ice cube between two cups. Back and forth. What do we have here? What is this?
I don't have a name for it.
We'll call it the LFO.
The Legal Face-Off?
Of course.
The gavel?
There you go.
The sound effects.
So that doesn't taste like alcohol at all. It's Friday. Happy holidays.
You have a bathtub and an oar over there in the corner.
Yes. It's rum, St. Germain, fresh lime juice, a little bit of limeade, and just a lot of alcohol. It's great.
It's awesome. It's delicious. Thank you.
I've taken over the sound effects role.
Don't get him started. I'm going to turn it on, and I'm going to get Pistorius here.
Where's Sammy? Where are
your
sound
effects? All right, I'll take care of it.
Please
you two start on the first topic, which involves the FCC repealing net neutrality.
Yes.
How about that for a segue?
It just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. So last
Tina
week,
demanded this subject, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I demanded
Tina
it.
Tina thought it was very exciting, but go ahead.
Yes.
It is important.
It is very important. Yeah. So the FCC last week repealed the net neutrality rules that were instituted in 2015 by the Obama administration.
Thanks, Obama.
Yes, which had required internet service providers to provide equal access to all apps and websites to internet users. This decision will now allow internet providers to give preferential treatment to certain ISP websites, and they can also give preferential treatments to ones that pay extra for speeding up the delivery of content. It also allows for certain websites to charge for access. And so this is a very big deal. This ruling also has now classified the internet as a Title I information service rather than a Title II telecommunications service, which means that the FCC now has less authority to regulate it. So this has led to a major public outcry with much discussion about the impact of the decision on things such as First Amendment concerns, as well as access to certain social media platforms. There's been some discussion about Facebook and Twitter, for example, potentially, and LinkedIn charging for certain types of access. And there have been many senators on both sides of the aisle who have signed on to a resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act trying to come up with legislation to overturn the decision. There have also been a few state attorneys general who've announced that they plan to lead a multi-state challenge to the repeals. So this is going to be one worth watching for a while, I think.
The AG who brought this in New York, I mean, Eric Schneiderman, he's been very aggressive in bringing these kind of actions. So I think one takeaway is that this is a sign, as we've talked about on the show, this is a sign of attorneys general, including here in Illinois, being very aggressive in sort of pushing the boundaries of what an AG can do. And we've seen lots of examples of them doing that, and this is one. And in particular, Eric Schneiderman in New York has been very aggressive at pursuing these kind of claims.
Second topic on the grab bag involves a federal judge withdrawing, and this is one of President Trump's guys.
Yeah, this was, I mean, the video went viral right away. Pretty hilarious stuff. You know, this was Matthew Peterson, and an exchange between him, who was Trump's federal judge nominee, and Senator John Kennedy, not that one, the other one. This is a Republican out of Louisiana, and he was asking him some basic questions that you would hope someone who is a federal judge could answer, and it was a car wreck. I mean, you couldn't take your eyes away from it. That's why it got so many hits. But he was asking him basic things like, you know, to a layperson, not basic, but to any lawyer who's been around for more than like a year could answer, right?
What's
a motion in limine? What do you call, do you know the federal evidence standards, the Daubert standard? He said he had never heard of that. He said that he had to reference some research on that. I mean, just a guy that clearly wasn't qualified to be a judge. And, you know, under some basic questions by the senator, it was clear that he wasn't prepared. And eventually they withdrew his nomination. So, I mean, Trump has been on a record pace in getting federal judges approved. I think he has like 22 or 23 approved so far, but this is one that didn't make the cut.
Well, and there were several of them. I did see the video, and then did you see Sheldon Whitehouse's tweet? That was pretty funny. He said, "You must watch this," and then he ended his tweet saying, "Hoo boy."
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but I mean, it should be noted that he was not practicing as a lawyer. He was like an administrative lawyer. But still, I mean, you would think maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but maybe for a few minutes before you stand in front of the Senate, you should get a Black's Dictionary and, you know, maybe look up a few key things you might be asked. Who's preparing these guys?
They're not preparing. So, that's the whole problem.
Yeah, not a great look.
Best movie judge of all time?
Best movie judge. It's got to be.
Oh, my God, my cousin Vinny.
That was Herman Munster. That was Herman Munster, right?
Yes, Herman Munster.
Chamberlain Heller was his name in the movie.
Yeah.
He walks in with a satin suit, and he's like,
Mr. Gambini.
Well, there's a couple judges. There's a couple actors who play judges like
all the time.
I like the guy in The Fugitive. Craig and I have a particular affinity for The Fugitive, but the
it's
judge
called
in The
obsession,
Fugitive,
not
really
an
good
affinity.
Yeah, there's a lot of great judges.
Another issue with somebody on the show Glee. This is Mark Salling. He has pled guilty to possession of child pornography.
Yes. Mark Salling, several days ago, pled guilty to child pornography possession. He was arrested back in 2015.
Puck,
yes. I actually saw
Puck from Glee.
Yes. Well, you watched that show.
Love Glee. You know that.
Yeah, that show is becoming like
he watches it for Jane Lynch, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she's hilarious. She's awesome.
Sue Sylvester.
So he was turned in 2015 when he showed the pornography on his computer to his girlfriend, and then she called the authorities. As part of his plea agreement, he admitted to having approximately 50,000 images and about 600 videos
wow.
of children.
That's a lot.
Some as young as three.
What?
Yes,
what?
It's pretty remarkable and very sad. So,
yeah. Oh, it's a lot. I mean, this case has been going on for a while.
It's been 2 years now.
Yeah.
3 years old.
Way to listen to our show old. Ever, Sam, because we've covered this.
I've never heard the age of three on the show.
Yes. Yeah. It's
usually we pick it up to 14, 15.
Yeah, no, three.
Yeah, it's pretty rough stuff.
Yeah, so he faced up to 20 years in prison, but it looks like he's probably only going to serve 4 to 7 years with 20 years of supervision and registry as a sex offender after that. He's going to undergo a treatment program. And it's not going to be allowed within 100 feet of where young children and young adults congregate, including places like schools, pools, playgrounds, and so forth. And he cannot be in contact with anybody under the age of 18 electronically or telephonically or otherwise. And he also has to pay $50,000 in restitution to each victim.
Yeah, so is that, I wonder the victim, I mean, is that to each of the 50,000 images?
Well, see, that's the whole thing, is that I'm not sure exactly how they define victim.
I don't think Mark Stallings has the pockets for that, has the funds for that at this point.
There's
only so much the Glee residuals will last you when you have to pay $50,000 to each of your child porn victims.
Well, yeah, whatever happens to him, he deserves it. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All-time tennis great Venus Williams will not be charged for her role in a fatal crash in Florida.
Yeah, the car crash was back in June. Got a lot of attention at the time. You know, she was blamed for this collision. It actually turned, you know, initially they had charged her with entering the intersection against the light, but then we saw a video. The video was released where it actually showed her legally entering the intersection on a green light. There was a 78-year-old who was involved in the crash, later passed away due to injuries. You know, Venus came out initially and denied responsibility. Of course, she was sympathetic to the victim. And just this week, the police have decided that she wasn't to blame, and they're not charging her.
Well, the family is still suing her, correct?
Correct, yeah, civilly. Mm. No surprise there.
We have a verdict in the Slender Man case. That's been something we've talked about, I feel like, for over a year now on Legal Face Up, but a verdict has come out.
Yeah, so Slender Man is a fictional character.
Not real, yes.
Not real, I mean,
I'm sure, while in this person's mind, he was very real.
Right.
Yeah, there was two girls up in Wisconsin who tried to kill a classmate. Just this week, one of them got sentenced to 25 years in a mental hospital. She alleged that she was told by this fictional character that she had to stab her friend. So she pled guilty back in August to attempted second-degree intentional homicide. Again, she claimed that she wasn't responsible and shouldn't be sentenced the same way you know, someone who intended to do that.
The girls were all 12 years old, too, at the time of this. They were all 12.
Yeah, exactly.
The two, you know, bad people and then the girl that got stabbed, they were all 12.
Yeah, now she's 16. This plea, if she serves the entire time, she'll be in her late 30s by the time she is released. So, yeah, I mean, you know, lots of people always have issues with people who stab, you know, a victim like 25 times, yet are able to avoid culpability because of an alleged mental illness. Who knows? Obviously, this woman convinced the court that she was, in fact, mentally ill.
You sound like you doubt it, Rich.
Well, I do. I mean,
as you laugh.
Well, I think if you, I mean, we cover this case and I've done some, you know, I've followed it. There was definitely some, you know, planning involved. I think it's a cop-out to allow her to spend time in a mental institution because she's claiming mental illness. So, yeah, I don't buy it.
We have a lawsuit pending. This is involving the Billy Goat, which is right downstairs here on Lower Michigan. Chicago's Billy Goat Tavern is suing St. Louis's Billy Goat Chip Company.
Yes. We've had a lot of trademark activity here on Legal
Your
Face
favorite
Off the
topic.
Last few years. Yeah, well, what do you... Why do you think that is, Rich?
I'm going to quote our ad. Tina Martini is the intellectual property attorney at... I can't quite do
DLA
the voice.
Piper?
DLA Piper.
Or the title. It's very long.
Hey,
it's
guys.
Very long title.
Settle down. Settle down. Yes, the owners of Billy Goat Tavern, which everybody knows here in these parts, especially because of the Billy Goat I call it a hoax, but it's actually... Sussler's in studio and he's laughing at me. It was the Billy Goat curse that the Cubs finally broke a year ago when they won the World Series. So Billy Goat Tavern is suing Billy Goat Chip Company out of St. Louis, who started using the name Billy Goat in 2009 in connection with the sale of chips in the St. Louis area.
Chips. You have to use the Billy Goat affectation.
Chips, no fries.
No fries. Chips.
Coke, no Pepsi.
That's right. Chips.
I'll leave that to you guys.
Clearly, so, I go there too much.
Yeah, apparently.
Right across the street.
So our,
and down into the subterranean universe that is Lower Wacker.
We should actually record from there sometime.
We should, yeah, if they'll let us.
I'm sure they would. They'd love the publicity.
Just don't bring these Billy Goat chips there.
Yeah, don't want to do that.
They actually had the nerve to open 3 Billy Goat chips in Chicago.
Well, they've spread. So, yeah. So, they've expanded their retail presence from the St. Louis area to 100
locations.
It's right
next door to Billy Goats.
Yeah, because they're really smart that way. Thank you for my drink. And so they have actually 3 in the Chicago area, and that's presumably how our friends at the Billy Goat Tavern found out about them. So Billy Goat Tavern alleges that this expansion, coupled with the fact that the company uses the name Billy Goat and uses an actual Billy Goat logo in its branding, has led to consumer confusion. Our friends at Billy Goat Tavern in the past year have greatly expanded the presence of their brand by expanding into retail sales. And they are claiming that chips were on the horizon for them when they found out that these folks are already selling chips using their branding. And so they are suing to try to get these folks to completely stop using the Billy Goat name in connection with food and beverage sales.
What's the verdict? You're one of the foremost intellectual property lawyers on this planet.
Well,
are they going to win or lose?
Well, they moved into what is Billy Goat Tavern's territory here.
Yeah.
So I think that they did that with some pretty aggressive tactics. So we'll see how this one turns out.
Oh, so you're not taking a position
on
it.
I mean,
symbol? That goat looks like the Billy Goat.
It does look like
the
Billy Goat.
They're using the term Billy Goat.
You know, I have not completely researched this case, but what I can tell you is when you move into somebody else's territory, especially when you've got such a famous brand locally, it's an issue.
All right,
so
Nikki,
we'll see.
Sam,
what I don't know is how long these guys knew about them, because
guilty.
That's something that you need to take into consideration.
Guilty.
Would you be confused if you saw this? Would you think that's Billy Goat Tavern?
I might, yes.
For their chips, yeah. You would think they're probably doing like a retail selling brand.
Yeah, like everybody else.
Well, plus, if you go outside the Billy Goat down in Lower Michigan, it says the original Billy Goat Tavern. And the word original goes right through
for
the goat.
Sure. I think that's
I would think.
Well, that's a great point. And also the fact they're using classic, like, denotes some kind of history that is part of the whole Billy Goat brand, right?
They knew what they were doing.
No question.
Crooks.
I mean,
let's
play this out. So what would be, let's say Billy Goat Tavern is successful. What would the next step be? Would they be able to shut down the company, shut down the operation in Illinois? Would they get damages? What are your thoughts on what the recovery would be?
I don't know to what extent Billy Goat Tavern has like a federal trademark registration or if they're just relying on common law rights. But if they can establish that their brand had renown in the St. Louis area, for example, and if they were able to, and then if they can establish that they only recently learned about these guys, they could potentially get them to completely have to do a rebrand.
Hmm.
But a lot of it turns on whether it's common law rights or a federal registration, the extent to which these guys knew about them when they appropriated their brand. Did Billy Goat Tavern act immediately after they found out about them, or were they around for a while? Did they wait until they moved into the Chicago area because
they
were relying on
common law? And the location's that big of a deal. I mean, if this was strictly a St. Louis company, you think it'd be a much weaker lawsuit.
Well, it depends, because if Billy Goat Tavern had the ability to establish that they have federal trademark rights and that somehow their renown went into the St. Louis market, which some people are able to do, then you could say that it's more of a national brand than just a local Chicago brand, and in which case they would have a stronger leg to stand on. And not just rely on Chicago rights.
All right, well, I'm tearing up my blueprint for Burger Queen of a whole chain of Burger Queens around the country.
Taco Horn.
Damn it!
Finally, our last topic on the legal grab bag. Apparently, the drinks are getting to us here on Legal Palooza Christmas style holiday, whatever. 'Tis the season for lawsuits.
So every holiday on Legal Face Off, we always have to talk about holiday specific cases. And so Christmas is no exception, but what I really, really hope that David, who is in studio, is going to tell us about
David? Who's this David?
Sussler.
Oh, yeah, Sussler.
Sussler. I want you to tell the story about the flaming menorah. The flaming menorah is a story we can all learn from, David.
I've got
Sussler,
his mic
don't
on.
Don't get shy here on the mic. Now's your big chance.
Okay, David, this is your big chance to tell us all about the Disney
you're
flaming
a real
menorah.
Person. First time ever in the studio.
Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus.
Yes, I exist. You know, much ado is made about the flaming menorah. A number of years ago, I was spending some time at a good friend of mine's house, and he accuses me of trying to burn his house down. It was Hanukkah.
A good enough excuse.
We lit the menorah. He went out. I went to bed. He comes home. He says, David, the house is on fire, which wasn't really on fire. But I'm like, well, what happens? Like, well, you set the house on fire. What happened is he bought a Walt Disney ceramic menorah, and it melted. and filled the house with smoke.
Who even knew that there were such things?
That's what I say. That's what you get for buying a Mickey Mouse.
Wasn't Disney anti-Semitic? Wasn't their whole thing? Maybe that's why it burned down.
Walt was, no pun intended, Walt was a flaming anti-Semite.
Yeah, so maybe there's something to it.
Maybe there is something to it.
Well, but hold on a second. All
did anyone sue him?
All users, both Jews and Gentiles like I am, mm-hmm. but I've used a menorah for many years. No, you do not go to bed with a menorah lit.
Yeah, probably true.
Come on, man.
The candles were just about burned out. Who buys
How drunk were you, Sussa? That's the question.
Not at all. Menorahs aren't supposed to catch on fire. That's what happens when you turn a sacred religious symbol into a
cartoon.
When was this again?
This was last week. 1996.
Wow.
And I'm still being accused of trying to burn his house down.
Yeah, we actually saw them a few weeks ago, and I heard the story all over again for about the 50th time.
Tina, that's not like you to bring up the statute of limitations like that. It's been
a long time. You two were married?
1996. Yes.
This was in the wild single days of Susser when he was doing menorahs.
He was burning houses down.
That sounds like a crazy party.
96, Radles, Lutkes, and Menorahs. 96, Rich had hair in 96.
Yeah, I did.
So did David.
I don't know where to go from here. Yeah. Are we
okay,
done
well,
with the
no,
lawsuits?
We're not. No,
oh,
we're
wow,
not.
That, that's just one.
Because that was just
that was
Hanukkah.
Not a lawsuit, though.
That was Hanukkah, and that wasn't a lawsuit, thank God.
How dare I?
So, yeah. So, there are a few lawsuits that are worth mentioning. First of all, a guy who dressed as Santa Claus who decided to take a picture of himself and to post it on Facebook holding a rifle decides to sue his former employer because his former employer saw the picture of him dressed up as Santa Claus holding a rifle on Facebook. And according to this gentleman from Michigan, decided to start a campaign at the place of employment to get him
fired.
There's
the rifle. There you go.
There you go. So he is claiming that the fact that he was wrongfully terminated was retaliation for him exercising his right to free speech as well as his right to bear arms. So stay tuned on that one. That one's pretty interesting.
He also claimed the right to arm bears, oddly enough, which is a whole other picture. But yeah, if you look at this picture, I mean, would you want this guy anywhere near your workplace?
Well, apparently his manager said to people at their workplace that this guy is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And he took issue with the fact that he was called crazy. I do think it's crazy to be posting a picture of yourself on Facebook dressed as Santa Claus holding a rifle, but that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
So the next case is actually are two involving nativity scenes. The first, which is a zombie nativity scene on a man's lawn in Sycamore, Ohio. And the second involving a mock nativity scene in the basement of the Texas State
Capitol. Jesus? Baby Jesus? Are you speaking? Even baby Jesus is offended by this nativity scene. There should be no zombies involved with the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
I don't know if I have zombies.
Your Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Well, it's going to say it's yours,
I'm
too,
looking.
Rich.
Hold on. Go ahead.
So, yeah. So, the zombie nativity scene. So, Jason Dixon, who is in Sycamore, Ohio, was actually battling with the city because he had this zombie nativity scene on display on his own property. And the city actually went after him, saying that the roof of the nativity scene violated the local zoning ordinances.
And 27 misdemeanor charges.
Yes.
How could there be
I don't even understand.
Like a no-zombie
No-zombie nativity rule?
Like, how could there be 27?
So in any
Seems
event.
A little aggressive by the town.
They decided to drop the charges, but Dixon thinks it may be time for him to either put the nativity scene into storage or to try to sell it.
It's another First Amendment case.
So we should all look for it on eBay. All you know, those of you who are interested in having a zombie nativity scene.
If there's anything that our forefathers wanted when they created our democracy, it's to give people the God-given right to dress baby Jesus up as a zombie. I think that is a principle of the First Amendment.
Or to dress the baby Jesus as the Constitution,
right.
Which apparently was in the Texas State Capitol. The governor decided to dismantle a nativity scene where everybody in the nativity scene, as we know and love them, was substituted with the three founding fathers, Statue of Liberty, and the Constitution. So in October, a federal judge said that the governor, who is Governor Abbott in Texas, had no right to remove this nativity scene that was put up by the Freedom for Religion Foundation, and that
the
it was unconstitutional. And then there's another final case which made some stories out there, which was the Archdiocese of Washington that had proposed to advertise on the side of buses, a Christmas website with three shepherds, two sheep, and a cluster of stars. And the Metro said that it violated a policy that they had against religious advertising. And a federal rule just judged. A federal judge just ruled a few days ago.
Well, how this drunk is, what happened. Is Tina? I mean, she's on her third Mickey cocktail.
No, I'm on number two.
A federal clerk judged the order. And...
Is the bar still open, by the way?
It's looking pretty low, that jug.
Well, I'm not the one who's going around saying, froof, froof. But anyway, so the federal judge just ruled that the Metro was well within its right to ban these types of posters.
Tina Martini, favorite Xmas song?
My favorite Christmas song, and Sussler, I think, may concur with this, is Chris Cornell's Ave Maria.
Absolutely.
It is amazing.
Absolutely.
It's a really, I mean, I am still just so sad about his passing this spring, and it is an incredibly moving version of Ave Maria. I recommend it to everybody.
Ave.
I like Step Into Christmas by Elton John.
I've never heard of that one.
Can you
sing a few bars?
No, I can't.
Please do, Sammy.
I'm a big fan of Dreidel Dreidel. I got to go with my peeps, you know?
It's a Christmas song?
No. Nah.
That is not a Christmas
Sussler
song.
Sussler and I are going to do, as we close out the show, we're going to do Dreidel Dreidel. Emily, favorite Christmas song? We got one? We got to get her on the mic. Nothing. A great answer.
Emily's in the house. A big shout out to Emily, who
Nikki, favorite Christmas
is awesome.
Song? Ooh. Ooh, tough one. Craig Collins, think of yours. Because
have another drink.
We're coming to you next.
You're so giggly right now. It's great.
It's a hard question. Yeah. I don't understand why this is hard.
Putting you on the spot.
By the way, did no one said Jingle Bells? That's obviously a great Christmas
Jingle Bells,
song.
No, that's sexist.
Easy.
We don't talk about that anymore.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's paternalistic.
Somebody called into our station last Saturday and said Jingle Bells is sexist.
Yeah.
Swear.
Nikki's looking it up as we speak.
What is a Christmas song? It's the Christmas symphony one with like it just gets more and more intense.
Trans-Siberian Orchestra.
Yes, thank you. That's my favorite one.
They're pretty good.
That's it? The last show of 2018.
That can't be it. It's 2017. Who's been drinking? Who's been drinking?
Springsteen's version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
I like that one. I prefer Merry Christmas Baby by Bruce Springsteen.
This morning I heard one I've not heard him do before, Blue Christmas. I don't know where it was recorded.
That's amazing. Elvis classic.
It was amazing.
That's amazing. I prefer when he does Merry Christmas Baby, but I'm a big fan of... Do They Know It's Christmas? You know.
Oh, that's amazing.
Awesome Band-Aid.
Okay, can we rattle off some of the singers you sang?
Yeah, let's.
Okay, start off with Paul Young.
You got.
And then you had
Bob
Boy
Geldof
George.
Actually doesn't sing.
No, he doesn't. You had Boy George.
You had
Simon Le Bon. You had George Michael.
Who knew we stepped into?
You had
an expert on.
You had Midge Ure and Bob Geldof. Who put it together?
You're forgetting somehow.
You had Sting.
Bono. Bono comes in. Very key point.
Yes. And then Paul Young does the bridge.
Mm-hmm. Somehow, what's that band who sings? Cool and the Gang somehow slips into the
into
video.
The British
the
version?
End.
It was a British. It was really the British one. Yeah, then you had USA for Africa that had a very similar song also.
There's a couple of random people who slip in at the end of that video.
Yes.
Dan Aykroyd's in there somehow.
Really? I don't remember that.
All right, play us off with a little Do They Know It's Christmas?
I don't have
it. It's Christmas time.
I'll be in the bar, though. I'm going to jump into the bathtub.
To the bar. Thanks to Nikki.
Yeah, thank you. It was a great year. I think it was a good 2017, right?
Cheers.
A year
of transitions, a year of change, but I think a solid year for the show.
I agree.
I bought fireworks.
Wow. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy New Year.